This talk was given by Bear Gokhan Bonnebacher at the Zen Center of New York City. Gokhan is a senior monastic in the Mountains and Rivers Order, coordinator for the National Buddhist Prison Sangha, and the head of operations at Zen Mountain Monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Refrain from unwholesome action. Do wholesome action. Purify your own mind. This is the teaching of all Buddhas. So this is from the text that we're studying this Angho, this spring training period. This is the beginning of this fascicle by Dogen Zenji called Refrain from Unwholesome Action. Later in the fascicle, he quotes a dialogue. Someone asks a teacher, what is the essential meaning of Buddha Dharma? And the teacher replies, refrain from an unwholesome action, do wholesome action. And the person who asks the question says, well, even a 3-year-old child could say that. And the teacher says, well, maybe so, but even an 80-year-old person cannot do that, practice that. And so Dogen begins his fascicle with this, on the surface, very simple teaching. Of course, we can all understand this teaching. And we can practice it. We should practice it. I don't think the dialogue the teacher is in saying that we can't practice this, but that it is difficult to matter, it's to master, it's not as simple as it seems on the surface. When we do practice this, truly practice this, what do we find? What unfolds? What do we see? Refrain from unwholesome action. Certainly he is talking about action, pointing to the precepts. Don't do things that cause harm, that disrupt harmony. And this is easy to understand. And when we look at it, when we practice it in our own life, we see it's difficult to do. It is a practice. Not if we're paying attention, if we're actually being honest about our actions, the effects. It's difficult practice. And then Svaskal Dogen goes further and looks more particularly, what does refrain from mean? What does it mean to refrain from? And so my understanding, this does start with the precepts. This does start with looking at our mind in action. But it's looking at our mind. So in our mind, what does it mean to refrain from? And when we practice refrain from, where do we find ourselves? What do we find? I've been reading recently Thich Nhat Hanh's biography of the Buddha, which is called Old Path, White Clouds. And it's Thich Nhat Hanh's telling of the Buddha's life, the story of the Buddha. It is very much Thich Nhat Hanh's voice, right? He's writing historical fiction. I don't know if that's quite fair to call it fiction, but he's putting his understanding, you can feel Thich Nhat Hanh in his telling. And, you know, I know this story pretty well. Thich Nhat Hanh didn't have any special, new sources of information. He's drawing from the sutras, drawing from the Jataka tales. But I've been touched by his telling of the story, by his telling of this life, the simplicity and the gentleness with which he tells the story, and the simplicity and gentleness of the story that he's telling of the Buddha's life. And Thich Nhat Hanh, and again, I think this is partly Thich Nhat Hanh, is very much an emphasis of his teaching. He emphasizes mindfulness. And so in this telling of the Buddha's story, there is an emphasis on mindfulness, on awareness, This is one of the earliest and foundational teachings of the Buddha, to practice mindfulness of breathing, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of mind objects. And I've been struck in this telling of the Buddha's story of how much time the Buddha and his disciples, so where I am in the story, he's become the Buddha. He has very quickly quite a few disciples, many disciples. And I've been struck by how much time they spend in meditation and in walking meditation, what we call kinhin. How much time they spend in silence, eating silently, even when they're with other people who are not monastics, they eat in silence. How much time they spend walking, just walking from one place to the next, from one town to another. The Buddha covered hundreds of miles on foot in his lifetime. And that when they're walking, just walking from one place to another, they're basically doing kinhin. They're walking in silence. They're walking mindfully. They're walking slowly, it sounds like. And when the Buddha or his disciples enter a town for the first time, the townspeople notice and are impressed, are take notice simply of the way that they're walking. And there's a beautiful story that I'd read before, the story of Shariputra, who was one of the Buddha's chief disciples. He was called the Marshal of the Dharma. He was very important in helping the Buddha to teach and to develop his Sangha. And he was a spiritual practitioner. He had left home. He was part of a spiritual community and practicing quite intensively. But it seems that he knew that he hadn't found what he was looking for. He hadn't found his teacher yet. And one day he was in town and he saw one of the Buddha's first monastics walking on begging rounds, and was struck just by the way this monk was walking. And just in seeing how he was walking, he knew that he had found his teacher. And so he went up to this monk and he said, who is your teacher? What is your teacher's teaching? And the monk kind of didn't want to say, you know, said, well, come meet him. You know, he is the Buddha. But Shariputra insisted and got just a couple of lines from him. And that was all he needed. I just love that story, that it was just the walking, just seeing how this monastic walked, and Shariputra knew. And I was thinking, you know, this was a very different time and place. The Buddhist monastics were not the only monastics or mendicants or seekers who seemed to be around, right? There were a lot of people, actually, different spiritual communities. But I was wondering, you know, how would people react today to see a group of monastics walking down Atlantic Avenue? You know, and it was a different time and place. But for us, always the question is, I think, should be, how do we bring it here, right? What is this now? And so how would people react now, right? People would notice. And then what? Would they come looking for the Buddha, looking for the teacher, asking, who is your teacher? And so what is kind of caught my attention the most in reading this is this very simple life that the Buddha led. You know, we ascribed to him, we call him the perfectly enlightened one. We ascribe to him that perfection. And there is that in this story, as Thich Nhat Hanh tells it. And he is changing the world that he lives in. Very quickly, hundreds of people become ordained with him, under him, and so are leaving their homes, leaving their families. That's changing the world that he lives in. And he was, it seems, quite brilliant, and so he's meeting some of the other kind of foremost teachers of the time, and rulers, kings, and his brilliance comes through, at least in the way that the story has come down to us. And yet he's just living this very simple life, walking, sitting, eating, begging for his food, owns just the robes that he wears, his begging bowl, doesn't really have a home, although there were places where he stayed for some time. And so just in this simple living, how radical the turning of his mind. So simple. I think he is practicing refrain from. And he is teaching. He's teaching people, others, to practice mindfulness, to look deeply at their experience. This has reminded me to practice mindfulness. Simply to look deeply, to look, to pay attention in each place, in each thing. We so easily, so quickly, so habitually get lost in trying to understand, trying to explain, and looking for something, and looking for something else, and looking for somewhere else. Something more tasty. This constant reaching, it's very subtle. It's part of what we see when we pay attention. This constant looking for something else. And so this simple teaching, this simple practice, just turn to where you are. Just turn your attention to what is before you, right here. Settle your mind here. Look deeply here. What is just right here? Who are you? Who am I just right here? And I feel like part of the sort of the reminder is how simple this, in being so simple, it's easy to miss. It's easy to kind of pass over it. Don't miss it. What am I missing? Don't think I've got it. And the Buddha, of course, teaches about suffering, the causes of suffering, the path. And in one part of the story, he's just come home. So he's been away for 7 years. He has become the Buddha in that time and has come home as the Buddha with his Sangha. Come back to his homeland. Come back to see his family. And he's invited to a meal at the palace, which used to be his home. And after the meal, and this is what would happen, people would invite monastics, invite the Buddha to a meal, ask if they could offer a meal. And then after the meal, the Buddha would teach, or one of the monastics would teach. And so he's teaching about suffering, the nature of suffering, the path. And says the Buddha paused for a moment and then smiled before continuing to speak. He says, but suffering is only one face of life. Life has another face, the face of wonder. If we can see that face of life, we will have happiness, peace, and joy. When our hearts are unfettered, we can make direct contact with the wonders of life. When we have truly grasped the truths of impermanence, emptiness of self, and dependent co-arising, we see how wondrous our own hearts and minds are. We see how wonderful our bodies, the branches of violet bamboo, the golden chrysanthemums, the clear stream, and the radiant moon are. Earlier this week, I offered a seminar on work and practicing at work. And I talked about having reverence for work, reverence for things, how work can bring us into, does bring us into relationship with things, with the tools that we use, the people we work with, the things that we touch, the things, the objects that we care for, that we can care for in work. And I talked about reverence a little bit, and someone raised their hand and said, "What do you mean, reverence?" And that was a helpful question. That was a good question. What I said was that I experience reverence as experience in the experience of wholeness. And when I see something, experience something in its wholeness, as part of wholeness, and that then I would say I'm also bringing myself into wholeness. So what is reverence? When I give beginning instruction in Zazen, I always say something about liturgy, how to practice liturgy, what liturgy is. And often I talk about bowing and how, well, so what are we doing when we bow? And that we are expressing gratitude and reverence, respect, and that we're cultivating these virtues. So we cultivate reverence. We can cultivate reverence. Practice it, bring it forth, even when we may not be feeling it. So in the Zendo, we practice reverence, respect, offer that to the Buddha, to the altar. We cultivate, practice bringing forth reverence in these particular circumstances, in the Zendo, so that we can learn what reverence is, so that we can, in a sense, know how to cultivate it. But it is not an idea. It's not sentimental. And in bowing, we bring ourselves closer. Closer to what? Closer to ourselves, to our whole self. And we bow to things, to objects. We bow to our cushion, to our seat, expressing reverence, respect, bringing ourselves closer. So what is it to have reverence for an object, for a thing, just as it is? Can we let it be just as it is? Not our idea of what it is. In this learning to allow things to be as they are, I think this is also refrain from. I was remembering when I first started practicing, I was at the monastery complaining to Daido Roshi about the liturgy and just kind of saying, you know, the monks wear those silly slippers and they do everything so carefully. And he just said, "What's the matter? You don't like to do things carefully?" There is a danger in liturgy, in doing liturgy, that we're kind of just acting, right? Just pretending. You know, we learn the form, we know how to do it. We know how we're supposed to do it. And maybe we're doing it correctly. But are we inside of it? Are we practicing with our mind as well as our body? Settling our mind and allowing our whole body and mind to be present in what we're doing. Practicing that. The form helps. The body can help lead us into relationship, into wholeness, to allow the mind to join, to follow. And so in a sense, we practice with the easy things. We practice with the form, with the support of the form, so that we learn to enter. That can be a place to enter, a way to enter. The same as that in Zazen, we can know that the awareness we experience in Zazen is always available. The care, the reverence that we may find in liturgy is always available. And of course, we bow to each other. expressing gratitude, respect, reverence, bringing ourselves closer. And I think we also find, you know, we may find reverence kind of more organically outside in nature, an experience of standing by the edge of the ocean, looking up into the sky, or something smaller. I was taking a walk the other day and the first magnolia blossoms were bursting forth over the sidewalk. So we also can bring that into the zendo, express our reverence here. All things have the same nature, all things existing just as they are. Ujjayama Roshi says, everything in nature is just what it is. We really shouldn't be playing around and tampering with everything. This, he says, is refrain from. There's a sort of exercise or practice that I've, I can't actually remember where I learned this, but you know, I think it was first during doing retreat or something in nature, in the woods. And the exercise, the practice is just to sit in one place and to let your mind be quiet and to just in the kind of circle of your vision, just sitting in one place to look closely and to keep looking. And so you can do this. Go find a patch of grass somewhere and sit and let your mind settle and just look just at what's right here around you, just close, and look closely. There's a whole world in a little patch of grass, a whole world. Each blade of grass is different. You can see each blade of grass. Each blade of grass is alive and radiant. When you look closely, when you bring yourself close, close without comparing, without judging, kind of without thinking about it, just bringing yourself close, just letting it in. You can do this sitting on a bench. There's a little park on Pacific that I go to sometimes, and do the same thing. Look up, there's a tree. Look down, and there's a concrete curb. Again, look closely, come close. And the curb is just as radiant as the tree, just as alive, just as wondrous. You can do this standing on a street corner. Cars, strollers, people, buses. Just stand and let it in. Signs and buildings and windows, lamp posts. And so look there, look there, look at this, look at that. And so it's more complicated here. See what your mind does, how it gets caught in reacting, in judgment, in creating a story, in explaining, in being attracted or not attracted, interested, not interested. What happens when you let your mind settle? And you just look. You just let it in. Just like looking at the blades of grass. There's so much more conditioning when there's more going on, when there's more kind of that we relate to and that we have a relationship with. But so how is it to see without judgment, without wanting or not wanting? And again, allowing things to be as they are, allowing wonder, allowing everyone who passes to be beautiful, knowing that even on the corner of Atlantic, complete, and so much suffering. This is also cultivating reverence. Refrain from, in a simple practice, looking deeply right here, right where we are, allowing ourselves to be right where we are. Last week, Shugen Roshi offered a retreat on looking at the practice of compassion. And one of the things that he said that struck me was he talked about how practice moves inwards and outwards at the same time. There's always this inwards and outwards. So what we do in our minds in a relationship with ourselves, and there is what we do in our relationship with others, with the world. There's how we perceive ourselves, our own mind, mind objects, how we perceive others, how we perceive things, objects, how we affect ourselves, our own mind, how we affect others, things, objects, the world. Uchiyama Roshi says, when people think of Buddha, they inevitably assume there must be some great, blessed person existing outside of themselves. But that is just not true. You shouldn't go around looking for Buddhas outside yourself. Our true identity as whole self sees all the Buddhas within practice. What we practice is just letting go without producing anything. This is the deeper sense of refraining. And so I was thinking about the precept to see the perfection, to not speak of others' errors and faults. Do not speak of others' errors and faults so that you can see the perfection, so that you can see the wholeness. And again, moving inwards, moving outwards. See your own perfection. Don't dwell on your own errors and faults. We get confused about what perfection is when we dwell on errors and faults, when we think that is what it's about, when we're caught in our judging, comparing mind. Nobody's perfect. We all make mistakes. When we're caught in good and bad, praise and blame, worried about our reputation, that's where we're confused and not seeing. Ajahn Suchito says, how good do you have to be at peace with yourself? I think his point is that it's not about good and bad. That's not how we're going to find peace with ourselves. We are complete. And how is this refrain from? How is this practicing refrain from? So I wanted to end with a poem by E.E. Cummings, and giving full credit to Shoan for this. This really is her poem. I thank you, God, for most this amazing day, for the leaping greenly spirits of trees and a blue true dream of sky, and for everything which is natural, which is infinite, which is yes. I, who have died, am alive again today. And this is the sun's birthday. This is the birthday of life and love and wings and of the gay, great happening, illimitably earth. How should tasting, touching, hearing, seeing, breathing, any lifted from the know of all nothing, human merely being, doubt unimaginable you? Now the ears of my ears are awake, and now the eyes of my eyes are opened.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.